Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 45 for Tuesday, April 13th, 2010. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me...
Dominic Rabier.
And Ben Snitkoff.
As usual, we have three wonderful stories for you this week covering legal news and the technology industry. First off, we have a story concerning the FCC, and does the FCC have the authority over internet service providers, internet practices as they pertain to consumers and to other companies? Second, what privacy do we have left in email these days? An interesting opinion comes down from a circuit of court that certainly questions what privacy we do have left. And finally, we have a discussion that we're going to cover on a paper relating to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and how it might restrict our free speech rights on the internet. So diving into the first story, we've got the FCC and an interesting opinion which came out of the D.C. Circuit Court this week. So if we rewind the clock back a little bit to 2007, you might recall that Comcast was sort of caught with its pants down a little bit. They were throttling the speeds on certain consumers' accounts, and it turned out, after several weeks' worth of news commentary and investigation from people, that they were inserting disconnect packets into connections between BitTorrent peers. And so it was causing the peers then to drop the connections, and it would appear that the traffic was being slowed down. So after a flurry of negative commentary from most of the tech community, including a lot of the notable news sites, the FCC stepped in, and they came out with some new policies regarding internet service practices and what ISPs can do to their customers, and also sort of launched a complaint which was in part brought by some interested people from the community and some private rights groups or advocacy groups, and they started investigating Comcast a little closely. Now, eventually, this made its way to the D.C. Circuit Court, and we had this opinion come down this week, and the ending conclusion that we got from the D.C. Circuit was that the FCC does not have the legal authority under the current law to cover what ISPs do with their customers and any of their methods in terms of network management. So first off, maybe we could talk a little bit about what the FCC is and why this opinion came out of the D.C. Circuit Court and why probably no one remembers having an opinion in a federal district court first. So I'll throw that to our panel.
It's because there was no opinion in a federal district court, because they appealed straight from the FCC's order.
And what did that order consist of? Does anyone remember?
If I recall, it was basically just saying that, it was a slap on the wrist to Comcast, saying that you can't, you know, insert these packets into, you can't treat some data different from other data, and it was basically an order, an agreement with Comcast never to do it again, with the agreement having legal force at the time that Comcast decides to break the agreement. So, you know, at the time it was just an agreement between the FCC and Comcast, but if Comcast then ever went and, you know, started tweaking with these users' data again, then the order would have some sort of legal effect.
Right, and I think another thing that came out of that order was that they forced Comcast to disclose to the public what their traffic or what their network management practices were. And it sort of forced full disclosure on what exactly they were doing. Because actually at the time, I believe back in 2007 or thereabouts, they had stopped sort of throttling or inserting these disconnect packets into these connections. But it seems that they continued to do some sort of network management in order to, I guess, at least under their banner, to keep internet traffic flowing smoothly. And so this got challenged, of course, as Dominic mentioned, in the D.C. Circuit Court, and it turns out that they do not have authority to regulate the Internet, or at least ISP practices. And, we're talking about the FCC, so it's the Federal Communications Commission, and historically they have regulated the telecommunications sector. Do any of you guys know why it is that they might not have authority, or what the court might have focused on a little bit in saying that they don't have authority?
Part of the big problem with the FCC's argument in this case is that there's no clear statutory authority for the FCC to regulate the internet. What FCC was relying on is it has ancillary power to regulate, you know, things that are related to telecommunications networks and lines, and they were trying to shoehorn their way into that to say that, you know, not only can we regulate the wires on which information travels, but we can also regulate how companies deal with the information that goes across those wires. And the big problem that they had is that the FCC itself had previously interpreted these kind of ancillary, the parts of the statute that give it ancillary power. It had previously construed them either narrowly or to not actually confer, you know, power to the FCC. You know, the FCC had even said, you know, yes, this is, you know, this is a policy statement more than actually a grant of power. And the court, at least in my reading, really focused on the FCC's own previous, the way the FCC previously interpreted its own statutes, its own enabling statutes.
Right. And why, I mean, why would we be so interested over whether or not the FCC has authority in this jurisdiction? And what are the bigger issues here that are really at stake for us as consumers?
Net neutrality? Go ahead, Ben.
Right.
I was going to say net neutrality, too. I mean, that's...
I beat you.
Yeah, that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, you know. The fact FCC's guidelines with net neutrality, I think they're still open for comment. I don't remember seeing anything that had actually been promulgated. But, you know, if, based on pretty much everyone's reading of this opinion, right now the FCC no longer has the power to promulgate regulations relating to net neutrality without Congress stepping in first and saying that the FCC has that power. And, you know, I don't know if the Congress is ready to grant that power. And certainly there'd be a big fight on the, or at least a relatively big fight on the floor of the House and Senate about, you know, the internet should be free and the internet, you know, should be, whether the internet should be free or whether the internet should be free of government regulation. It'd be kind of interesting to see which legislators took which side of that debate. But
Now, I kind of recall, and I actually don't know the specifics on it, but I think as far back as 2005, the FCC did have some sort of authority over ISP practices on in terms of not just network management, but in terms of access that they could provide to people. If I have read things correctly, I think in 2005 that was deregulated, and that's sort of the point at which they lost official control over regulating ISPs. Do you guys remember anything about that at all? Or did I just make that up?
I don't remember anything about it, but I don't know that you made it up. Very possible that it happened. I just didn't catch that story.
Yeah, I mean, that was several years back now, so more than 5 years ago. But I think that sort of, that was the start at which I remember a lot of net neutrality arguments that were popping up, or actually probably even before then when that was kicking around. But I mean, I guess so. Some of the important points to draw out of this at this point is that the FCC, and I often forget about these little quirks about administrative law too. It's an agency, and their authority to regulate specific things is governed by statute. And so, of course, what they do have authority over is subject to statutory interpretations. And so this ties back into political stuff. So that all depends, of course, on what types of laws are actually being enacted, you know, that are created by Congress and then eventually enacted into law after the whole legislative process. So the bigger question here of net neutrality, this used to be just a big topic of interest to us geeks as we were sitting around and we were all worried about it. I think hopefully now that this is going to pop up and be a little bit more of a public discussion issue. Really quick, can any of you guys summarize what net neutrality is really all about?
Basically, I guess the broadest definition that I understand net neutrality mean is it doesn't matter where the packet's going and it doesn't matter where the packet's from. All packets are entitled to the same level of service from all service providers. So a step back, the internet basically is a giant relay network. Packets, which are contain information, are sent from server to server, and each server relays these packets on to the next server. Think of it sort of like the airline hub system on steroids, with millions of hubs, basically. And what net neutrality basically argues is that packets heading for a destination shouldn't be given priority or shouldn't be given special treatment if they're, for example, a packet involved with BitTorrent, or a packet that is the service provider's own service, like suppose Comcast is doing video on demand. Net neutrality would say that it shouldn't give priority routing to packets that contain its own video on demand services, as opposed to, say, Hulu's video on demand. Is that a fair explanation, would you say?
Yeah, I think it is. And I mean, I think people are a lot more worried about the latter. You know, now that Comcast owns NBC, you know, is Comcast going to try to, you know, slow down streaming from ABC.com to users? Because they have that power right now. Right now they could make ABC.com unwatchable across millions of internet connections across the United States. And it's stuff like that. They could even try to hold that bandwidth for ransom. Say, you know, we won't slow your traffic down if you pay us more money to, you know, compensate for, you know, your traffic that's going across our network. And that's a very legitimate concern, especially as, you know, corporations get more properties and, you know, more vertical integration from Comcast, which is now, you know, going all the way up from production at NBC to distribution both over cable and over internet.
So what really concerns me about this is that the problem is really twofold. You've got internet service provider companies, people like, or companies like Comcast, they own these infrastructures and which amount to access points to consumers on the internet. But in addition to that, they're also offering services like cable TV to your home, and also voice communications to your home, whether those come over the standard twisted pair or whether they're routed through the internet might be another debate. But so they control all those things, and as those types of services move to the internet, you can get streaming video online free at places like Hulu. And you can get voice over IP services through programs like Skype, and there are a number of other programs available. You would think that those companies, or those internet service providers slash people who are distributing content, whether it's TV content or that those voice services, might be a little bit concerned that this stuff is going free on the internet. And so then it seems that they've got sort of a vested interest in ensuring that people are still distributing over those more traditional methods, you know, getting the TV services to your home via TV, because then the consumer has to pay for it, and of course the distribution companies are probably paying something too. So in terms of net neutrality, it's you worry about being a consumer and what you're going to have to pay in order to get access to it, because let's face it, in every geographic area, major metropolitan area, say like Boston, like the three of us live in, there's really limited choices in terms of how we get our internet service and our TV services. I, for one, here in the building that I'm in, I can only get Comcast. I could probably pay some high cost or additional amount of money to, say, Verizon to get Verizon's services wired into the building. I think they offer a basic DSL. I know that the Fios stuff isn't available here. But really, I'm not really willing to pay that. You know, I'm not willing to fork over $500 up front, so I have to go through Comcast. And if Comcast moves to either like a tiered system where they start charging for more bandwidth by, you know, or, like say they have two plans. One plan says if your basic internet services will cost you $50, and that only gives you 100 gigabytes a month. But if you move up to this next tier and pay 150, we'll bump that up to 300 gigabytes. Of course, if you're streaming video and stuff like Hulu, it's going to cost you as a consumer more money. So definitely it's an oligopoly in most markets, and I am concerned that if this is left unchecked, that we're going to see things kind of go haywire. And then you worry about the foreclosure of competition to companies who are just up on the internet. YouTube, because it's owned by Google, has like almost infinite cash resources to pay for extended bandwidth. But if you're a startup company in someone's basement, can you really afford to pay exorbitant fees just because you stream video or you stream some sort of content that that sucks up a lot of bandwidth? I don't know if you can, and it makes it harder for companies to offer new services on the internet if they can't pay for them. Any of you guys have anything to add to that, or any additional thoughts?
I think you summed it up pretty well.
Yeah, the one thing I would add is that with your example of, you know, YouTube and the startups, you know, they're already paying for bandwidth once. They're paying it to get it from their servers to, you know, essentially the main pipeline. And one of the problems that people see with net neutrality is that, you know, suddenly Comcast will want a fee for that traffic going over their network, and Verizon will want a fee for their traffic going over their network, and AT&T will want a fee for the traffic going over their network. So you really have this tax of these people paying for the bandwidth that they use several times over. You know, meanwhile, the end user is also paying for connectivity to the internet. So without net neutrality, you're going to have, you know, it may end up with lesser costs to someone in this chain, although it's not likely, but you end up having people paying for the same bandwidth over and over again.
Yeah, right. And that goes to kind of what I mentioned really quickly about there just being access points. So if you just have a few in each geographic network, but there's definitely areas out there where Comcast doesn't offer its services, you have to go through some other ISP, then you have the worry that companies will be charged a fee to access Comcast customers in addition to being charged a fee to access Verizon customers and Time Warner customers, and the list goes on as to how many ISPs there are. But all of that infrastructure, which has been in place arguably for 25 or 30 years, probably even longer than that, is owned by those companies, and it's really cost prohibitive for a new ISP to come up and offer competitive services in those areas, unless they're really well funded. At least I don't know if there's any other way that they can suddenly get access to some of those key infrastructures. So I guess we'll just have to wait for now and see if Congress has a reaction to this ruling which came out of the court, and whether or not they're going to provide for some sort of specific legislation that allows the FCC to step in and create policies that regulate how ISPs treat their network management practices. So our next story actually is an interesting one that relates to email privacy. This sort of ties into a larger political debate, which has apparently been kicking around. Apparently, this guy who is running now for the Georgia Attorney General position was a former DA, or is currently a DA, and he was involved in some investigations of a hospital, and there was a nonprofit organization which was apparently doing some shady activity. But in the course of that, this DA had subpoenaed for phone records and email records too, and in the I believe it was the 11th Circuit had a really interesting opinion on what constitutes privacy in terms of emails, and they used a line of reasoning which is more typically applied to phone records and this thing called the third-party doctrine. And basically what they said was that there might not be very much privacy left in emails altogether. Once you click the send button out of your email program, you no longer have any expectation in privacy. So if any government entity wanted to, or if they were conducting a criminal investigation, they could step right in and basically obtain whatever it was that you had sent in an email. So it's probably helpful before we talk about the decision itself and whatever implications might come from it. What exactly is what are the tenets of the Fourth Amendment, and what really is the right to privacy?
Thanks for giving us a nice, narrow question. Easy to answer there, Dave. essentially, the Fourth Amendment keeps citizens safe from unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. The intent behind that is that people should, I don't know how to phrase it other than, you know, free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The tenet is that it protects people and not places. So you can't claim that just because a place was searched that, you know, a place was searched illegally, whatever information they got should be suppressed. That isn't a fair argument in most jurisdictions under the Fourth Amendment. Well, it's nowhere under the Fourth Amendment. Some states have modified that rule a little bit. But what it does do is if some place is searched where I have a reasonable expectation of privacy, the best example is the home. So I've got a reasonable expectation a reasonable expectation that no one's going to come into my home whom I don't invite or who doesn't have a valid reason for being there. And as such, the government can't just barge in to my home whether or not I'm there and start ransacking the place looking for things. And that's a reasonable expectation both that I have and that society thinks, you know, society thinks it's reasonable that, you know, people shouldn't come barging into your home and looking for stuff. You know, on the flip side, I don't have any type of reasonable expectation of privacy in the hallway out in front of my, you know, my apartment in my apartment building, because lots of people come in there, and you know, the society isn't ready to say that no, you know, we're not going to say. I mean, you can look in, you know, from the rear door, which is big glass, you can see right through the hallway. So, you know, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy there. Things get a little dicier when you're talking about just documents, and specifically documents that have been going, you know, over the internet and from one person to another, especially in this case where there is a an intermediary that holds on to the document. And I think that's where the court really concentrated in this case.
Yeah, so it's probably safe to say that for certain things, people in the general public enjoy what we call this right to privacy, and they have this expectation that the government cannot just step in the course of an investigation and without having some sort of court oversight or some sort of due process under which the investigating agency or if it's a local law enforcement has to establish that there's some sort of probable cause that there has been a some sort of criminal misconduct. Absent, if they can't do that, then those areas where we enjoy that expectation of privacy are they remain private up until that point where the agency or the local law enforcement can show that there's that probable cause. And I guess as we move to the internet and we talk about documents and data that send back and forth on the internet, people have trouble applying those traditional laws sometimes to it, and there's been a number of legislations or legislative activity in the last 15 years or so, including the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which establishes that with certain types of data retention, third parties who are the intermediaries in things like email or other data that's going back and forth, that if there's some sort of entity that is conducting an investigation, there's a bit of oversight that is required before that third party, say it's Google, and we're talking about Gmail emails that are being passed back and forth, before that information gets handed over then to the agencies. So with regard to this case, I guess the allegation here is, and this suit was brought on behalf of the guy that was actually being investigated, and he claimed in the case that his right to privacy had been violated as this DA went in and subpoenaed the records for his email, and apparently what was turned over was the whole content of his emails, and he argued, I believe, that under the law, it wasn't so much the case that the contents of the email could be turned over. Does that sound right?
Well, from what I understand the decision, the 11th Circuit is basically saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, this guy sent his emails. Therefore, since the ISP had access to the emails because he sent them through the ISP, he doesn't have an expectation of privacy in the emails that he sent. Therefore, it's fine for the government to ask the ISP for the emails and look at them.
Yes, that's right. I think another important part in the analysis was not only did he send it to the IS, not only did he send it through the ISP, he sent it to another person. I think that also has some bearing on the way they decided this. And I've got an example once we got it. I can give it now, or we can wait until we talk about this a little more.
Well, here, I got a quick example, and maybe you can also provide your example after it if it's more helpful. If I send a letter through the U.S. Postal Service, and I address it, say, to you, Ben, and, you know, I insert some sort of letter into it, do I enjoy basically that right to privacy in the letter that I'm sending you up until the point that you get it and you receive it, correct?
Yes. So when you write the letter, I don't have, let's say you write a letter and you've got it in your hand. Right now, I don't have any expectation of privacy with regard to that letter because it's in your possession. Once you put it in the mail system, both of us temporarily have an expectation of privacy in it. And then once I receive that letter, David, you no longer have an expectation of privacy in its contents, but I do. And what the court did in this case is they confused the fact that you have a... I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. They basically said that because, David, right now you don't have an expectation of privacy in the letter that Ben is holding, we can go into your email and, you know, read that letter. But the problem with that is, you know, they would have to either subpoena that letter from me or, you know, they basically are, Sorry, I'm having difficulty phrasing this right now. They're ignoring the fact that you, David, still have an expectation of privacy to the version of that letter that that's stored on your computer and that should be stored on, or may or may not be stored on the ISP's computer. But, you know, if they want to, while you don't have an expectation of privacy on the one that's on my computer, they would still need a warrant to get the one that's on my computer unless I voluntarily hand it over to them.
What bothers me is it seems that, unlike email, which necessarily passes through third-party servers, and if you're using online web services, is passing through an entity like Google through their Gmail program, you've got that intermediary point at which a government entity like a DA's office can then step in, or like they did here, and obtain the contents of the email. And since it's being sent instantaneously, basically, unless you want to count the milliseconds it takes to make that little hop, you know, I would enjoy the expectation of privacy through the hop, but it would seem that you would need, or they would, the investigating entity would then need to obtain the warrant to get the contents of that email from you, not from the entities themselves, or not from the intermediary entity, not from Google, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
So why did the court say that there wasn't any expectation in privacy at all once I click sent, or send?
I mean, I can't give you an answer other than they got it wrong. They just seem to confuse the fact... sorry, you go, Dominic?
My understanding of why they did that is because they're basically analogizing email to a telephone record. So a telephone record is, say you make a call, you submit the number to your telephone carrier, and they connect you. That you don't have an expectation of privacy in the number, because the number is what's used to connect you, and it's passed clear text to your telephone provider. The court seems to be saying that email is just like a telephone number. The address you send the message to, you don't have an expectation of privacy. And here's the step where I disagree with the court, but I think this is their logic, and the content of the message, because you're passing it clear text to your service provider, you don't have an expectation of privacy in that either.
That's where they totally lost me, is that the analogy that they used just did not seem to fit well at all, because telephone records are nothing like sending an email. I mean, I guess you could say on some really confused level that it's, you know, making a phone call because it's like being an instantaneous communication.
Well, realize that, I mean, we might have judges on this court who don't use email. They have never heard of this technology, or they've heard of it, but they might have never really used it. And they have lawyers arguing and trying to give them analogies to help these judges who are unfamiliar with email relate to the idea of email. And apparently one lawyer told them the analogy, possibly, or they came up with them themselves, that these are just like telephone records. This is sent entirely open. Like, imagine passing notes in a classroom. You don't have an expectation of privacy of notes that you are passing with the visibility of the note for all to see. Email is like that. I mean, if you want to sniff the data stream, you can, and you can read people's email unless they're using encryption, and almost no one uses encryption because it's kind of a pain to set up.
I don't think your note analogy is perfectly accurate. If I fold over the note and I pass it to somebody, yes, everyone
knows.
No,
it's not folded over. It's not folded over. It's open.
So I typed it in, you know, a 64 font, and I'm carrying it on
yes,
a poster card from one
passing
to another.
Giant, yes, yeah. That's their analogy to email. Obviously, I disagree with that, but that seems to be their position, that just like a telephone record is publicly given, so too email is, or not publicly given, but just like a telephone record is given.
Yeah,
telephone record is given, email is publicly given as well.
I really just fail to see the logic there, because I mean it's like saying, oh, because this could be intercepted, therefore you don't enjoy any right to privacy. But on the same lines, though, when you send a letter through the postal service, someone could intercept that pretty easily. I mean, there's a number of points. If I'm sending a letter across the country, I mean, just think about all the different points that it has to go through. It's kind of similar to the way that an email has to make those hops through the internet servers, and either of those things might be intercepted along the way. But that doesn't really affect the status of the right to privacy that you get through a letter sent through the postal service. But the judge seems to think that or something along those lines. I don't know if this is probably not a perfect analogy to his reasoning, but he seems to think that you don't have a right to privacy once you're passing it through the intermediary entity because it's out of your hands. The logic just doesn't fit with me because I would rather see something closer to, well, first of all, there's legislation more specific like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which specifies rules for handing over data that you have from people. But aside from that, I mean, the analogy just doesn't seem to fit. I mean, that the purpose of that law, the ECPA law, it seems to basically give emailed almost rights or privacy rights similar to what you would have through the postal system because you're passing it through those intermediary entities. So I guess we're probably all in agreement here that the court seems to have gotten it wrong.
Right.
What do we think might happen then? Because this is a circuit court ruling. The next step in appeal would obviously be either an en banc rehearing before the 11th Circuit, which would be a larger panel than it was originally heard for, a larger panel of judges. Aside from that, if they were to either be denied that right to an en banc hearing, then their only other avenue would be to appeal to the Supreme Court. Is that right?
Yeah, the EFF has actually already petitioned for a rehearing en banc, however you want to pronounce it. So, that's pending before the court now. And if that's denied, you know, they'll almost definitely file a petition for a writ of certiorari to see if the Supreme Court wants to take it. But there's no telling whether or not the Supreme Court would actually take up the case.
And it definitely seems like all of our opinions here are in concurrence with a lot of the legal community out there. I have seen a number of posts, although I haven't read them in detail, which go through very specifically through the opinion and explain why their reasoning is incorrect. So it very well might be the case that this is just an awful decision.
Yeah, and we'll post a couple of those links in the show notes, so you can head over to the website and check those out.
Moving on to our final story, which involves a law professor who is probably near and dear to all three of our hearts, Wendy Seltzer, who is a fellow out of the Berkman Center for Internet Society. That's a research institute that's run out of Harvard Law School. It's actually an entity that I'm affiliated with myself, for full disclosure purposes. Wendy penned a paper which was published this week, and she argues within this paper, it's about a 60-page paper if you include all the footnotes and endnotes, that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or the DMCA, through its safe harbor provisions, which is another topic that we discuss commonly on the show, might violate or be very restrictive of free speech rights on the internet. And we've talked a lot about this on the show, about how the DMCA might be used to sort of usurp litigation or just litigious processes in the court system. I don't know that we've ever really addressed it in detail. So I thought we could take this time, this show, to sort of go over the points of what exactly the DMCA requires and how it actually functions, and at least in Wendy's view, also how it might be violating the First Amendment. So, first off, does anyone want to summarize Wendy's points in her paper?
The main point is that essentially the DMCA allows somebody to send a letter to, you know, a site like YouTube and say, I own such and such a copyright. This particular video, and give a link to the video on the site, infringes that copyright. I'd like you to take it down. That's the type of thing that you wouldn't be able to do through the court system without the court really taking a look and just seeing, you know, whether or not it infringes copyright and whether or not there's fair use. And it'd be a rather lengthy and drawn-out process. A good example of this is the J.K. Rowling's litigation. That involved the Harry Potter compendium, some sort of Harry Potter dictionary, where there's a website that compiled definitions of things from the, you know, Harry Potter universe. They were going to publish a book, and J.K. Rowling sued, saying, you know, you can't publish that. I was going to publish that, and regardless, you're infringing my copyright. And this case dragged on for months as to whether or not, you know, even a injunction would issue as to, you know, whether or not they could release the book. And that's the kind of thing that you'd have to go through every single time, you know, some sort of relatively lengthy and drawn out court proceeding, where at the very least the court will consider the First Amendment, at least through fair use, and say, yes, we realize that there's some tension between fair use and between copyright, and we're going to balance those. I'm sorry, between copyright and the First Amendment, and we're going to balance those using fair use as, as a guide. But that's the kind of, that analysis really plays no or very little part in DMCA takedowns. And they just happen, kind of a knee-jerk reaction.
So before the enactment of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and I'm not even sure that the legislators who were behind the DMCA really considered how important this was going to be down the line. I mean, maybe they did. But before then, the process of going through a takedown or trying to get somebody's content off of a website, say, that a copyright holder believed to be infringing, all had to go through the courts. You had to basically start a lawsuit, and then throughout the process of the lawsuit, you had to obtain a preliminary injunction, which requires certain showings that you have basically a strong likelihood of success on the merits of the case before the court would actually issue an order which says, okay, this content needs to come down offline. Now, sometimes that can happen pretty quick in the court system. I mean, you still have all the costs that are associated with getting an attorney if you're the rights holder, and then, filing all the documents. I mean, I don't know, it can vary so much on a case-to-case basis, but you're probably talking about spending several thousand dollars as a copyright holder in order to get that preliminary injunction and then eventually go to the copyright suit itself. Now, fast forward, we have the DMCA. They've got this notice and takedown system, which completely eschews the courts, basically. So you send the takedown notice directly to the company, like YouTube or whatever the website is, and we're talking about third-party content now that is being posted by individuals who are not the service provider. So these people are people like you and me who are just posting the videos to YouTube. And when they post something that's potentially infringing and a right holder identifies it in a takedown notice, then there's a set of requirements under the DMCA that they have to abide by in order to enjoy this liability limitation. And the liability limitation, what this really gets at is that those rights holders cannot sue a company like YouTube and eventually get damages from the company like YouTube for copyright infringement that was actually done by the third party or the people like you and me who are uploading those videos. The problem, though, is that when those takedown notices are issued, the statute basically requires the service provider, the YouTubes out there, to take it down immediately. And then the next step is that the individual person, those people like you and me, can issue a counter notice, and if they believe, for instance, that whatever they uploaded isn't infringing, they can then assume all of the liability for it and say, look, we don't think this is an instance of infringement. Please put the video back up, and then get it put back up. And then if there's any other action that to be taken by the rights holders, they can go about it and do it. But the problem is that I guess most people really aren't really all that familiar with the law and the ability to issue a counter notice and get the content put back up. So I think Wendy is arguing that the whole process of initiating of going through these takedown procedures and the fact that the service providers have to immediately take down the content, it almost functions like a restraint on free speech because you can get videos taken down immediately, and the majority of people out there are not going to do anything to get the video put back up. Do you guys have any problems with that logic? Is that, I mean, do you think that this is the case where a lot of people's free speech rights are being impinged on?
I mean, there are certainly token examples of when this happens. There were cases in the election when certain videos were taken down because people were asserting copyright over them. I think there were campaign ads that used, 4 or 5 second clips from, like Fox News, and those were being taken down off of YouTube because, whatever Fox News or MSNBC had some sort of crawler that would look for clips of their shows and just automatically send takedowns. Meanwhile, there's a very good argument that it's fair use or even that, it's, protected under, political speech under the First Amendment. It certainly happens that people's free speech rights are infringed by this system. The question is, does it rise to a constitutional level? Because one, we're dealing with private parties in an entirely private system created by statute. So, does the fact that Congress acted, is that enough governmental intervention to find that this is an unconstitutional infringement on free speech? I think that's a tough argument to make.
Well, to me, it's more like, do we want the courts handling all these little takedown issues? I mean, it seems that she's really saying is that the problem is because this whole process takes place outside of the court system, there's no authority there that the courts have immediately when those issues are, or when the takedown notices are going back and forth, to even make any determination of whether someone's free speech rights are being violated. But I mean, the problem with that though is that if we do kick this back into the courts, wouldn't the court system get a little clogged with these little hearings that
It
I mean
would
I
completely clog the court system. There's so many DMCA takedown notices that go out every day. Like, it would just. It's not feasible to put it into the courts. Like, it would be years or months before most of these things would even come before a judge, even for a quick 15-minute hearing.
Right, and I kind of recently I saw the statistics on how many videos are uploaded to just YouTube every day, and that doesn't include all the other types of content that is put up on social media type websites all around the internet. It's a huge number. It's a phenomenal amount of data space, and the process though of the DMCA takedown, as much as it might be hated by a lot of people out there, it's more efficient. It's much more efficient than having to go through the courts. Do you guys see any reasons though why we might want to have the First Amendment considerations put into play through some sort of entity, whether it's the court system or whether it's I don't know, some sort of judicial arm that's created just to handle these types of complaints?
I think it's important to throw that in. I think it could be done more easily with some sort of legislative fix, though. I don't think we need to create a special tribunal to adjudge DMCA takedown notices. All you need to do is say that you can't send a takedown notice unless you, among the requirements of a takedown notice is you need to say that you don't believe, you have a reasonable legal basis for not believing that fair use applies to that clip. And then, institute some sort of penalty for, if, you would then be able to send a counter notice and say that, I'm putting this back up because I think fair use applies, and then some sort of damages if it was a clear-cut case of where fair use doesn't apply.
You can, though, initiate a lawsuit, though, if a takedown was, in fact, fraudulent, though, right?
You can, but I don't think anyone's decided whether or not fraudulent takedown notices, and I think the standard is where you knew or should have known that you essentially didn't have a copyright over it. I don't know. I'm pretty sure no court has decided whether or not that includes fair use. Whether or not, if there's a thing, let's say it's a, going back to the campaign ads, it has that 5-second clip from MSNBC. If you send a takedown notice, you send a takedown notice, and all you need to do is say, "I own a copyright in that clip from MSNBC." That's fine. I don't think the court's decided whether or not you have to consider fair use before you send a takedown notice. Can anyone fill me in if they have?
The what most people, and we've debated this before, and I think the conclusion that we've came to in the past is that we don't know because no court has really, or no court that we're aware of has really weighed in on this heavily. I do think though that most people, most legal commentators out there are accepting the notion that fair use has to be considered in these takedown notices. I
Right.
mean, the real argument is whether or not fair use constitutes an affirmative right under the Copyright Act, or whether it's just a defense to infringement. So it might be the case that something you upload is inherently infringing, but you have a defense to it because it's fair use if you've added some additional commentary to it. The problem with fair use, though, I think, is that there's no clear-cut basis for what fair use is. I mean, sure, there are cases you can point to which say, look, this is definitely fair use, this is definitely not fair use, but that whole range of stuff in the center is really ambiguous because the judge has to make the consideration. There's those four factors of the Copyright Act that they have to consider, and the only way that you know whether something is fair use is if it goes before a judge.
The case to watch on this issue of fair use and takedown notices is the Lenz v. Universal Music case. Recently in February, the district court granted the motion for partial summary judgment, but they still haven't resolved it on the merits. I think we covered it on a podcast. So
that's the Dancing Baby to Prince, Let's Go Crazy, or whatever that song is.
Yeah. Yep. That case. That is, I think, the leading case that we have on fair use and takedown notice, because basically she was saying that you guys didn't consider fair use before sending the takedown notice. So.
Right. Well, so getting back to Wendy's paper, and just before we wrap up here, I think that the points that she makes are well taken, that there is or that there are restraints on free speech which do occur through this notice and takedown system. I just don't know that we have an efficient way to handle it where there is judicial overview at this point. And, you know, I'm absolutely willing to concede, though, that you can have your free speech rights impinged on by companies who issue takedown notices. Do you guys have any final thoughts on what Wendy argued in her paper?
I'm all set.
All set here.
In any event, her paper is definitely worth reading, and it's freely available online, so we will post a link, of course, in our show notes. Thanks again for listening this week. This was the Technically Legal Podcast. I was your host. My name is David O'Brien, and with me...
Dominic Rabbi.
And Ben Snitko.
As usual, you can follow us on Twitter at @TechLegal, or you can send questions or comments to podcast@technicallylegal.org, and be sure to check out our website, technicallylegal.org, for blog posts and other commentary that we have on cases that are kicking around in the courts and other legal issues. For now, we will see you next week.